I'm here in Kingston with Yvonne Grant, MBE, who is the Administrative Director of the Open Arms Development Centre. So thank you very much for agreeing to meet with me today.
Yes. And thank you very much, Dr. Hayes, for coming to the Open Arms Development Centre.
Yeah, I really appreciate the invitation today, because I think that our conversation will highlight, will help people maybe have a bit more of an idea about how Open Arms functions, but also its role, how it works in conjunction with the British government as well. So could you tell me a little bit about the centre, about when it was established, And your role here?
The centre here was established in 2006, but it came out of the Ministry of Local Government having a committee called the Committee for the Homeless. Well, I had worked in the committee, in the community, with mentally ill and homeless persons. And as a result of my experience as a community mental health officer who worked previously within the Ministry of Health Department, I was asked to join the committee. And on joining the committee, we were asked to come up with a 5-year strategic plan looking at homelessness in general in Jamaica. When I talk later on about myself or how I got there, I have a lot of experience in dealing both with persons on the street, persons who are homeless, and persons with mental illness. On presentation of the 5-year strategic plan, the government really did not have the resources at the time to start anything. So Dr. Maureen Irons Morgan, who chaired the committee, was also the senior medical officer for community mental health. I had worked with her previously, and so she offered that we could use a little building that we had at the end of the Bellevue property to start operations. Bellevue Hospital gave me 2-3 members of staff, and they offered to give me a stipend to pay me, and so we started as a drop-in center on November 6, 2006.
And just to explain then, so the Open Arms Centre is we're opposite the hospital, is that correct?
We are at the end of the hospital grounds. So they have allocated us legally all the grounds that we now operate from. So I started off as the administrator, and so we were able eventually to, we had a management committee. And so we now have a fully structured board. We are a registered charity, and everything about us is legal. And as I said, we started off as a drop-in center. So over the years, we have improved and expanded. The drop-in facility is very small due to COVID. So we are not really taking persons drop-in because of the restrictions that were established. However, we moved into residential care, rehabilitation programs, reintegration, and resettlement programs. Just to say, from day one, we had involuntarily migrants from all over the world who were also part of the homeless population.
So you would welcome migrants, so people who maybe had found themselves in a precarious situation. Yeah. Where did these migrants come from back in 2006?
The majority were coming from the USA. Then we have a few from the UK. We had from Canada, different countries in Europe. You know, wherever Jamaicans go, we have persons coming. And so they've come from all over the world, it that way. And so we were able to develop our programs. And very soon after we started, especially when we moved into residential care, And you'll see all the buildings we have now. These were all derelict buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So I had approached the Bellevue Hospital management to ask if we could use the buildings, and they agreed. And with volunteers and donations, then we were able to take it one stage at a time and started having persons staying in residence.
So how many beds do you have at the moment?
All right, we have our capacity is 85, but it can go up based on if there's any disaster like a hurricane or things like that, we could take up to 90. That is men, and we have a little house that houses 8 women.
So how many men do you have staying with you right now?
At the moment, we have 82, no, 42 men.
42 men and how
yes.
many women?
And 2 women.
Okay.
Simply because of the COVID and the restrictions, at one time we were not admitting, and it was very rigorous. So we have just recently, since last month, started, you know, with precautions, taking more persons in.
So prior to 2008... There was no form of structured program that facilitated the integration of deported people into Jamaican society. Is that correct?
Well, we weren't doing any integration, but 2006-07, they were coming in getting food and clothing, but because it was an 8-to-4 situation then, with just the drop-in center being open in the day. But once we moved on into residential, then now it's 24-hour care.
From 2008, then, the British government began something called the Reintegration and Rehabilitation Programme.
Yeah.
So their aim there was to provide support to economic development and social welfare in Jamaica. And the intention then was to help the Jamaican government reintegrate migrants who are returning, but also to improve governance around the management of the prison population. Is that correct?
Yes.
So how did you become involved with the RRP? What was the relationship there with Open Arms?
Well, everybody knew that we were dealing with homeless persons and that we had involuntary return migrants that we were taking care of. So we put in our bid, and they offered. And from day one, we have been receiving funding for the, you know, to take care of. At one time, it was all everybody who needed care, and then it's down to IRMs, the British IRMs. And
what was the living situation of the migrants? In that time period, what stories were they sharing? What kind of experiences were
before
they
before they came to us?
When the centre was set up,
most of them were living on the streets. One or two were in living situations that we would say they weren't welcomed or they weren't happy. Some were with relatives, but well, the persons who could not afford to feed another mouth or to take care of. But I think the majority were off the streets.
And were the majority of them deported people, or were they people that came to Jamaica and then found themselves in difficulty, or was it a mix?
The majority were persons who were deported.
Okay.
Yes.
So the US authorities and the UK authorities mainly would deport people but then have no plan in place, no structure to actually receive people, and that's a gap.
No, apart from they maybe would have gone to a night shelter or wherever they could get food, that sort of thing.
So tell me then, once you began to receive funding from the British government and really have support to then provide this infrastructure and provide this facility.
Yeah.
So Open Arms not only provides and provided short-term emergency accommodation and support to UK deportees, but you also, I understand, you put on workshops and
But it's not really short-term.
Sessions.
It's difficult to call it short-term.
Okay.
A few persons might be short-term in that we could find relatives quickly, or they could find a job very quickly, but that there are issues there. It's more that it's medium to long term, because
and how long are we talking about?
Everybody we're talking about, based on the individual needs, because each person is individually interviewed and assessed, so it's based on the individual.
Do you have people with substance abuse problems?
We take in everybody.
Everybody.
Everybody. We take everybody. The only persons we don't take, if they are too seriously disabled, if they are senior citizens who are not coping, then they would go maybe to the Golden Age home. And if they are acutely mentally ill, if you know they are really disturbed, then we would see to it that they get to the mental hospital. And then after discharge, we would take them. You know, once they're stable, then we would take persons in. But we don't really just say, no, no, no.
And does that
do something.
Does that involve a conversation with Bellevue Hospital then to receive?
Yes, yes. We converse with everybody, Ministry of National Security, the Security First for Services, Health, Education, Social Services. We communicate with all the various government and non-government organizations in order to get, because let's face it, one, they're still here, they still need to have health care, that sort of thing, you know.
Okay.
So I was saying that once we started, when we started now with our residential care quite early, when we go around, you'll see we have the residents that have the section, we have two open dorms. And the place we call Maureen's Place, which was named after one of our co-founders, the same Dr. Maureen Irons Morgan. So we said we'd name it after her, because it was her idea to put in single rooms occupancy. So when the British came in, they gave us funding.
Who specifically came in? What conversations did you have? Was it with the High Commissioner, or was it with staff? Sorry, at the High Commission. Or was it with, for example, was it with people who had travelled from the UK to look at the centre?
No.
Was it more people based in Jamaica?
I think it was maybe through Ministry of National Security who alerted them of Open Arms, and they reached out to
us. Because you also work, there are other, as I understand it, there are other NGOs as well.
Yes, there are other NGOs like Open Heart and Portland Rehab, those sort of things.
And do they serve similar functions, or is there a difference in the way that Open Arms?
It's difficult for me to say. It's similar and yet it's different, because I can tell you Open Arms exactly what we do. Straight away, the British, when we wanted to refurbish Maureen's Place, they gave us the funding, quite a lot of money. Thank you all very much.
Do you want to say how much?
I couldn't say no, because it might not be exact.
Yes, it'll be on record.
It was
anyway.
Yes, it's on record somewhere. They'll have it. But we were able to put in the single room occupancy, and they gave us this money, and you know, we negotiated and said, all right, we'd have X number of spaces specifically for the British IRNs, so that when they came in,
could you expand what an IRN is?
No, so IRNs, the involuntary returned migrants. Mm-hmm. So the negotiation was that all IRNs coming in that we accepted, as long as they could cope, you know, if they were too ill, as I say, they would go to the hospital in that. But coming straight, we would house them in Maureen's Place, where each involuntary return migrant would have a nice little room, and you'll see the place when we go around. And eventually, I think we started off with about 4 rooms, and then we up it to about 8. So right now we have 12 rooms reserved.
And there's the 12 rooms that are reserved for IRM specifically?
Just from the UK.
Specifically from the UK. So do they get to talk to each other then?
When you go around, everybody. Yeah, they don't stay in their rooms. They just sleep there at night, and they have their belongings, and, you know, they can keep it safe and things like that.
And what kind of stories do you hear then from people who've been deported from the UK? What's their personal situation, or how did they find themselves?
I think most of them, the majority went and overstayed. That's the overstay.
So then the majority of people who travelled from Jamaica on a Jamaican passport arrived in the UK and stayed
for some of them a long time. And then there's another group who went over as children, and I don't think you're old enough to know that children used to travel on the adults' passports. They didn't have a passport of their own. And they went over as children. Some of them are quite young children.
Mm-hmm. Would these be children of Windrush generation?
Possibly, possibly, or after, soon after, or whatever. But during Windrush, a lot of children were, and youngsters were brought to England. And they just grew up believing that they were British citizens, and they never thought about themselves as being anything else. Even if they went up as children, you know, 10, 11, 12, they never thought of. So they didn't think it related to them at all.
And what kind of situation then did they find themselves in? Was it that the Home Office would contact them to say that they were aware that they didn't have the documentation to remain in the UK? Or how do you know anything
some
about the
deportation picked up,
process?
Some persons were picked up, and I think they went to lawyers and tried to get to stay, and eventually some of them had committed offences, you know.
So some
and
were from the prison population,
yes,
but others
are just
everyday citizens who found themselves in that
situation.
How do you feel about that? How do you see that situation?
I have mixed feelings. I have mixed feelings because I went there as a teenager, and I went in my teens. I had my passport and everything, and
where,
it was just before.
Where did you go?
I had my passport and I had everything when I left to go. I lived in Stockwell.
Stockwell. And was it a Jamaican passport you had or a British passport?
No, it said British. Then it said British because Jamaica had not.
Because you were born.
Not independent.
Apologies, but could I ask what year you were born in?
I was born in 1943.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've never had anything else beside British, yeah. So, but I think I'm smart. Because when I heard that Jamaica was becoming independent, I investigated it all.
So in 1962?
That was, yeah.
So
I came
back a long way.
Just
long
before
way back.
The independence, I went there in. Queen official birth. 62 I went, but I went in June.
So you arrived in the UK just before the Jamaican independence.
Yes.
What a historic moment. What an important... What do you remember from that time?
I don't, because I wasn't here for it. So I don't remember here. I don't know anything about the celebrations or anything like that, you know? You only heard about the politics and say, well, this one is for it or that's for it. But I have no history of the actual independence itself and the celebrations when they say it was such a high and all of that.
But you said that you found out about the situation and about the past. How did you do that? Who did you speak to? Where did you go?
It was in the news, and relatives would be telling us, you know, you'd get letters. And
in the news in Jamaica? Or
it would be in England.
Okay.
So,
can you remember any occasion, what you read or the information that you received about being Jamaican?
It was
Jamaican
just that there was not much, there was nothing to say about a Jamaican in the UK after independence or anything like that. I don't remember hearing anything about that at all, because I mean, I was here years, and then when I started investigating and listening to things and all of that, and that you will need a Jamaican passport now, and things like that, and that you were actually not British citizens. Then I applied for my citizenship in England.
Can you remember what year that happened?
Can't remember.
Can you remember the cost? How much it cost?
It wasn't a lot at the time. Whatever it was, it wasn't a lot of difficulty. I didn't have any difficulties. It must have been about in the 1980s, I would think, early 1980, that I around about that time, from 70, yeah, it was about late in the 70s or early 80s. That I'd applied for my British citizenship. Could have been the 70s, thinking about it now.
So now do you have dual nationality now?
I have dual nationality.
So how did you obtain your Jamaican passport?
You just have to apply for
it. So when you return to Jamaica, then you...
No, I had it from there. I applied from it there, okay. From in the UK. Yes, you just went to British High Commission and to the Jamaican High Commission and fill out the forms and things and got it there. But, and so, yes, to get my citizenship, I didn't have any problems at all. None at all. Just fill it out. Went down in central London, got there, got the papers, and then it was granted. So, yeah.
So how does that contrast then with the stories that you're hearing from some of the people who've arrived at Open Arms?
Well, some persons never applied for anything. The majority never applied. Or even when they tried to apply, it was when they were either incarcerated or when they were when they saw a lawyer before they were returned. So I don't remember anybody who had applied legally. And, you know, the law keeps changing because they're talking mm-hmm. about Red Book and all of these mm-hmm. things and indefinite stay. I don't know anything about those mm-hmm. things at all. So the different laws, and it's just that a lot of persons who came back had never applied, or they a lot of the younger ones would say that they didn't really know that.
And how young? How young is maybe the youngest person that you've had?
About 19 years old, 20 years old. Yeah, because we don't take anybody under 18 plus, so that would be. I think the youngest is about 20. Yeah.
And as I understand it, part of the services you provide is helping reunite deportees with their families and their friends. How do you go about doing that?
Okay, we question them. Number one, before that, we have to get them documented, because they will come.
Yeah.
The documentation is early, and that can take a long time. And it means that when they are processed, after they're processed and we might pick them up or they come to us, they have no identification at all.
So talk me through that process of somebody who might arrive here with absolutely no documentation. So effectively, I mean, I suppose you might argue that they're stateless because they don't have documents, but effectively it's because they're not, they don't have a legal identity document that proofs who they are, that states who they are. So
to collect them at the processing center, the persons from the Immigration Bureau and the officers would hand over the person to us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And we would take the person, but the person doesn't have any. They would say, this is John Brown. And so we would take the person, because prior to them being returned, the passport and immigration persons would have to certify that they, or else they couldn't put them on a plane without coming with those documents.
Yeah.
So they actually land with documents. However, we don't get any of those documents, and they don't get any.
So as I understand it then, the function of Open Arms is not so much, its functions change principally, because when it first started out, it was taking people in from the street.
Yes.
But now you're directly taking people who have come from the airport, is that correct? Are
yes,
you involved
yes,
anyway in the transportation of these people?
Mm-hmm.
Or is that another service that...
Once they are documented, then if they're coming directly to Open Arms, we'll take them.
So are they detained at the airport until they get their documents and then they come here?
No. They're
sent
to us the same day.
Okay.
Same day. So it's only because of COVID while they're doing it at the at the airport. But normally they have a center that they are taken to, and then all that work, preliminary work, is being done. And then if they're coming to Open Arms, then we'll collect that person. And there's another organization right now, the National Organization for Deported Migrants. If they are going to be taken in different parts of the country, that organization would take them there. But we would take the persons who are coming to Open Arms directly.
And does that just depend on capacity as well? Are there some months where you don't have the capacity to take more people?
We've never come up against that.
Okay.
But how, I mean, if tomorrow morning we got more than 12 persons, we would have spaces in the dorms that they could go.
So how does that process work then? Sorry, what organisation contacts you to say that then they're sending people to Open Arms from the airport?
Well, the head of police is the sergeant. I would get a call. The various persons, Ministry of National Security.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about national security. So they would be on site as well, mm-hmm. because I would be alerted both by the British High Commission,
mm-hmm.
the Ministry of National Security,
mm-hmm.
and the police services.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Constabulary, the mm-hmm. head, the superintendent. So three sets of organizations would say a deported migrant is here, or expected to come at a certain time. When they have all done the processing or in the process of going through all the documents and everything, somebody would call me right throughout the day, Ms. Grant, we have one for you. Oh, Ms. Grant, we have two for you. Ms. Grant, we have, mm-hmm. so I'll be alerted. I would literally go there with a member of my staff and escort the ones who are coming here to me.
Is there any separation then of people who have been in prison, so effectively criminals?
No, we don't.
Are put together.
Yeah.
And
you see, if they have committed an offence here and they're looking for them, then the head of the constabulary, they would deal with that.
Okay.
Yeah, so we wouldn't. If there's somebody that they are concerned about, confidentially, they might say, Ms. Grantham, we're concerned about this person. But we are not told what offences they have committed or anything.
Right.
It's only what the individual tell us, because all that is kept confidential.
Confidential.
So that to reduce any stigma or anything like that. So we just take persons in as IRM.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm interested then in this documentation process. How does that work once somebody has arrived at the airport?
Once they have arrived at the airport,
so whatever. Do they go to a special section of the airport, I would imagine?
Yes, where it's confidential. And as I say, if it's not COVID or a place, they just enter a bus. They don't come through like everybody else. They would discreetly, where the planes are nearby, they would just go into a bus. And they would be taken to the centre where they are processed.
And usually, I know that the UK clearly charters flights as well, and there's been a lot of controversy
mm-hmm.
around the chartering of flights specifically to deport Jamaicans.
Mm-hmm.
So do they arrive on, is it commercial flights?
Some persons come on regular commercial flights, and then the...
Do some people self-deport as well, or are these
people can agree to come?
Because you talked about the involuntary return migrants.
We call all of them involuntary. Voluntary returned, right?
So there are people who've approached the British authorities,
mm-hmm.
said they want to return,
or they've been they found them
right.
for some reason, especially for overstay. And they say, all right, we leave.
Right, but they'll be flagged on a flight then, and they'll be taken to be processed.
They'll be processed and they'll be let out. But their system is very different. They don't really necessarily, if they want to come, then they wouldn't be coming to us. Maybe if they come and they fall on hard times or something, and then they would we'll just admit that person.
So how does this documentation process work? Do people they encourage them from the UK to bring everything they have, right? Every form of...
They're not given anything.
Do they arrive on any form of documentation? Are there people that come here? I would imagine there's people that arrive without a passport, right? They travel without any form of ID.
No, they travel with the ID, because they have to have the identification to get on a plane.
They have to be processed in the UK to be able to travel.
Right. But the travel documents are withheld by passport and immigration. Right. So it's withheld from them,
mm-hmm.
which means that when they come literally out the door to come into our car, they have nothing. So when they come to us, they have nothing. It means now we have to start from scratch and go over the same process that was gone through to get them on the plane in the first place. So we have to get them a birth certificate.
A Jamaican
birth certificate. Because they wouldn't have any other unless it was illegal, yes?
Yeah.
And even if they had the old birth certificate. Say they went there during Windrush and they traveled on the old. Jamaica has new birth certificates, so they would still have to get one of the new birth certificates. Okay.
So what do you mean by a new birth certificate?
They have changed the whole system.
When did they change the system?
I'm not sure. Because when I came back, I came here in 1997 and they had already changed it.
But they've also computerized.
Things, yes. But it's a whole different look.
Process,
it's a different document altogether. And
right, so they get the new Jamaican birth certificate.
So we have to apply for that. That costs money.
How much money?
I think it's about 4,000 Jamaican dollars at the moment. It's not cheap.
That's not cheap.
2 to 4, something between 2 to 4. It depends on if you're happy.
Is that the British taxpayer that pays for that?
No, we have to pay.
Is that through donation?
We pay. So if we get in our project beneficiary
allocation
for year.
Okay.
If it doesn't say documentation, then we have to pay for it from donations. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, they need the birth certificate. They need what is called a voter's ID. They're going to change that to a national identification, but we don't have to pay for that one. It's mainly the birth certificate we pay for. Mm. Then they have to, we say TRN. It's the tax registration thing.
Yeah, the tax registration number.
Yeah, we call it something different in England. You have to see with me because I still...
Your national insurance.
Yeah,
you also help them with driver's licenses and things.
Well,
like that.
Driver's license, if they had one to renew it, we have to pay for that. I'm not sure. It depends how much. But the idea is a birth certificate does not have a picture.
Mm.
So they have to have a picture identification.
And
so that's why.
And biometrics as well. Do they take people's fingerprints?
No. But we have to have a picture identification. So even if they have a birth certificate and they have the TRN, then they still do not have a picture identification because it's not on the TRN. So that's where the voter's ID comes in.
Right.
And that's where the driver's license come in, because those two, because some things you're doing, like opening certain accounts, bank accounts, you need 2 picture identification.
Right.
So even if they can get money from abroad or anything, they won't be able to get a picture identification in under 6 months. Because the voter's ID, they only print them twice a year.
Mm.
So if you miss it, you have to wait until
That's
6 months. So they'll be here for 6 months or
waiting
more,
on documentation.
Waiting on a picture identification.
What kind of issues does that cause then? Do people
it
get
creates a lot of issues, because some of them, they might have a little money somewhere and they want to open a bank account. And, if they're not at open arms, then, we do it legally and say, But there's so much we can do.
So they need relatives sending them money. They need a voter ID and they need a driver's
license to be able to open a bank account. Some banks will take one, but you need a picture identification. So.
And do you help people with, tell me about the kind of workshops that you have here and the kind of training.
Okay. Right, so when they first come, they need a lot of psychological care. So we have to do detailed assessments, detailed individual and group work with them, just because to get them settled, and getting them settled can be very difficult. And that's when also we try to have them have links with family. So we have a computer room with computers and things so that they can go on social media. Some of them have children, at least they can see them, they can talk with them, those sorts of things. And, and keep in contact with the relatives there.
Yeah.
And at the same time, very often, they might not know some of their relatives here because they might not have been back. So the relatives abroad are very helpful to say you have an auntie there or you have some cousins there, or they might have heard of them, and we try to link them with them.
Have you had the case of anybody who's been here who has no family whatsoever in Jamaica, has no connection to anybody because they've either been in the UK for such a long time?
Yeah, some of the older ones would not have any
Or they might not have known how to, well, because they weren't aware of how to so-called regularise their status in the UK, that they didn't even think they were Jamaican or that they had a link.
A lot of them don't think they're Jamaican because, remember, especially the ones that went over younger, it's hard for them to even begin to think of themselves as Jamaican. It's just as we take them out and take them places and they begin to get used to the culture, then they might never, some people might never think that they are Jamaicans, because some families would bring up their children, or I put it this way, so when I went to England in 62, in some areas there weren't a lot of Jamaicans or black. We moved to Nice then, and there were hardly any black people there. Yeah, so where the children go? They went to Bridge. They went to school at Bridge School. Yeah,
yeah,
and they were nearly all white children. Maybe one or two cousins that they might have met, or one or two others. And so they were just real, real British people, and they went through that school system. Parents, it's not all the parents would have a tight link with Jamaica or come back and bring them back. They'd never been here. They'd never come back. So they just see themselves, everything about them is British. And so it's very difficult now for those ones to say. And plenty of time, even growing elder, we had a man here. He's a senior citizen now, he's moved on. But he was more or less adopted by an English couple down in Kent. you know. So
he had white parents.
Yes. So he was brought up. So even now, he, on one level, you might say, yes, Jamaica, but at heart, there's no Jamaican there at all. Is what I'm trying to say? There's none.
No, it's
that he doesn't know it. He never know you bring up and brought up down in Brixton or in places with a large black population and things like that. And sometimes they see the worst part of the culture. They don't see the better part of it. And even though they say, oh, yeah, you're the man or whatever. But deep down, everything else about them. So that's hard. And sometimes you just have to take them that they accept that they are here. And sometimes they say, it's only for a while, I'll be going back, whatever. Yeah. And I say, well, make sure when you go back, it's going to be legal. you know, so. And the gradually persons. But that's very difficult. So linking with back to family is important.
So would you say that you've encountered anybody over your career and in this position, would you say you've encountered anybody who has been potentially deported under false pretenses that were British, that were entitled to their documents, but maybe because they didn't understand the system, or they didn't update their documents, or they just...
Grant, somebody taxis here.
1 second.
Yeah, there was one young man, and but he had moved on. But recently I heard that his case turned around and he returned.
Okay, so how did he... And he came here, he stayed at Lippen Arms, did he? And
just several years ago.
And how did he get support for that? What did he do?
I think it was after he left here. While he was here, he met relatives.
Yeah.
And they took him, so they must have worked on it.
And he was able to get his British passport.
Yeah. Okay. But only of that one person that I have heard of. Yeah, because I think he went up quite young as well. So,
We've seen quite a lot about, it's called a Coming Home to Jamaica booklet, DVD.
Yeah.
And this was information that was provided by the British High Commission.
Yeah.
And I understand that Luc de Noronha, he writes about this in his book as Deporting Black Britons. What do you know about, were you ever involved in giving kind of information, leaflets or information? What kind of information did you provide to people, or do you provide?
The information was just making them aware of what happens when they actually come. A lot of our input was just saying open arms what we would do, and also the input was information of the health system, where they would get how to get to the health centers, registering with the health centers, those sort of information, mental health clinics, where they were, and those sorts of things. It was mainly how to get around and to get access various services. It wasn't extensive, but it was. It was sort of an introduction to Jamaica. And, you know, because they, while it's not fully as the British health system, but we have general hospitals now that persons don't have to pay. And if you go to the health centers, it's health centers around the place. You might have to wait a little bit longer and that sort of thing. But it's a very similar structure. And but some of it can be expensive. But there is backup and things like that. So we tell them about it.
What do you know about the Windrush scandal in the UK? When did you first hear about it? And was it talked about really at open house?
Windrush is something that a name that was always there, the name of the ship. And that's what it was to us at the time when I was living in England. Yeah. So it was just they came on the ship, and then we would say, you come on the ship, but I came on the plane. So it's only since they're talking about a scandal now that prisoners say, but I went there at the same time. I was there during the time when the Windrush was coming in, and we had relatives coming on the Windrush and things like that.
But when did you hear about the scandal? Was it in the newspaper, for example, or was it maybe word of mouth or on the radio? Was there something that...
I think it's people talking about it. When people started to demonstrate in England, and you know, they were seeking redress and that. Yeah, because I get a lot of the British news, and especially when you when there's a protest or people are lobbying. So that's how I first heard about it.
And did you have any discussions with the British High Commission here, for example, or with maybe any Jamaican politicians, or were there any discussions that were raised about what was happening and the kind of controversies around people being deported from the UK? Was that something that kind of was involved in, maybe became a part of your meetings?
Yes, it was always in the British meetings, because we used to have, with stakeholders meeting, I think it's once a quarter.
Tell me about the stakeholders meeting then. Who was sat around the table and who would you
Anybody who is everybody. You know, the NGOs, the various ministries, people were involved in, you know, from the High Commission, of course, sometimes other High Commissions.
But talking specifically about the British situation, or talking about more broadly about the migrants?
When the British called it, it was really mainly about the British.
So they headed,
it was headed by the British High Commission.
So what were
they were chairing all these meetings.
Yeah, and what were kind of the agenda items that were on the table during those meetings? What were the main concerns that came up?
I think one main concern is that when people are returned, that number one, British is going to do everything to do it, make sure it's legal. And a lot of it is making sure that we do what we say we're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. You know, they were... They whatever we said we would do, they wanted to know that we are doing it, and that we were actually working together, so that whatever services the IRMs are getting, it's well structured, well organized, the money is spent wisely, as those sorts of things, and just giving. Bouncing ideas and different. It's not that the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. Various organizations would say, well, this is where we are, this is what we're doing, this is the issues we're having. And, you know, we would just work together to see and.
But it was very much led by Britain.
They called the meetings.
I think that's interesting
meetings,
as well. Because I'm looking at some statistics here of
So these are statistics from the Planning Institute of Jamaica, yeah. The National Intelligence Bureau, of the total number of persons returned between 2000 and 2012 by country of residence. And overwhelmingly, the most people were from the US, which was 19,987. Others, there were others, 5,936. Canada as well, which is a large number, 2,781. And the UK, which was 12,357 persons recorded, which is a high number, right? So in terms of persons, returned persons, the UK is the second largest
country.
Would you say, so how involved was the US then in not present?
They don't give.
So they don't provide funding or...?
They don't provide funding. Canada, once or twice we might get donations. None of the other countries. British England is the only country that provides funding.
So since 2008, the UK, through its, as we've spoken about, through its reintegration and rehabilitation of forced returnees to Jamaica programme, has been very active and very present.
Very active, very present, very much so.
Why?
I wish I had the answer. It's not for asking. It's not for engaging. It's not for, whenever I go to functions, I meet with them, the high commissioners. And let's face it, they do communicate with me, because when they have persons coming in and when they're having issues, and the Canadians, they would always call me, we have so-and-so coming or whatever. And I said, what about some funding towards it? Oh, yes, we're going to do, never. The UK, the US don't even ask. They just send. They send out a charter flight every month.
Right.
Every last Thursday.
The strategy then from the UK has very much been to one of collaboration, one of using development funding, international development funding, to support NGOs and community organisations.
Community organisations.
So it's to give the impression or the of kindness, really, of doing it in a way that a humane way, if you can say that.
I'm still, as you can see, very much British, and I always tell them it's the best, because you understand volunteerism. No matter how you have to work, you volunteer for something, you do something, and it's just that kind-hearted nature of being compassionate and being caring.
Okay. Yeah, but within a system that's brutally violent, right?
Yes.
Because the part of the deportation infrastructure that is being built is shockingly violent, right?
Yes, yeah.
So do you have any I'd be interested in, so who were the high commissioners who attended these these stakeholder meetings besides the British High Commission?
Sometimes they have reception, America come, Canada come, and they have a little.
Were there any other Caribbean nations that would
visit?
Yeah, they might talk about the UK deportations, might have an interest in them. No? Okay. And do you have any, are there any unanswered questions? Are there any things that maybe issues that you think the High Commission has not addressed in terms of that you think were important for to support you in your day-to-day work and support the centre and the needs of the people who are residents here?
No, I don't have any issues with it. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful. All our questions are usually answered. I mean, they talk to us on a weekly basis and more than weekly, and if we have anything to say, we work it out. I don't have any issues at all. None at all.
So, do you have any contact then with people, with former residents? So people who've either been able to reconnect with family or have been able to find employment or...
We do have contact, but some of them just once we... especially now we're doing the reintegration, the integration, and we are dealing with persons who have never come to Open Arms. So our interventions has widened a bit. That is very beneficial, but we do have interactions. But some persons, once they get to a certain level, they want to forget more or less and put that behind them. And we don't have a problem with that. But there are others who will turn up from time to time, and we have a link, and we can. But and then they are excelling in what they are doing, so that's behind them.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, there's still some stigma attached. So persons, we respect their wishes when they don't always come forward. We had mentioned about you'd asked me about the enterprises.
Yes.
And the, right. The enterprises that we are doing, that's usually very active, is skills training. The skills training is barbering. We haven't been doing it lately because I'll show you our skills training room. It needs major upgrading because sometimes we use it for small conferences and meetings and that. So, and I must let you know, it's 28 of my friends came from England and put a roof on that building. It never had a roof, and did a lot of things to it. And the British came in and gave us the money for the computers. They're getting a bit old now.
Sorry, how many staff do you have working here as well as residents?
Right now, we are really down on staff. It's through the COVID and because our numbers are down. So I have the caseworker. My rehabilitation officer died, but I have another one who started, just came in straight away. And so right now, we have 3 on day duty, and we have 2 night and a security. So
5 or 6 people to 80 residents. Yeah,
we don't have 80 right now. We have 40, but we'll up it as we admit in more.
Yeah.
So what we employ is, like, we have our caseworker. I haven't got a secretary now, so we're doubling up because we, you know, only 40 we can try and manage. But we also have a secretary. We have 2 or 3 rehabilitation officers. We have 2 psychiatric aides because most persons come in and have mental health problems. And then we'd have 2 night staff and a security for the women's house because they are separated during the day. So that's our staff. We don't employ a cook because a lot of our residents have food handlers, and we train them and they can get certified on the job here. So it's the participants who will help to run the kitchen. And we don't employ janitors. They're on duty rosters, so they must learn to cook and clean and take care of the property, that sort of thing.
So I'd like to hear a little bit more about you now, because I understand that you were recently awarded an MBA.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about how that came to be?
All right. It means I have to go to the beginning. All right. Born in Jamaica. As a teen, went to England, and I finished schooling, college, Colindale Poly. And went into, in the meantime, I got married, having children at the same time.
How many children?
I got 3 sons. They're all born in England. They're all there now.
Oh, they're in the UK now. Which part of the UK are they in?
Well, we moved out to Harlow. So one is in Harlow. He's married now 30 years. He's got 3 children. The other, second one lives in Birmingham. The last 2 lives in Birmingham. The one in Birmingham, he works at one of them companies that does pensions and that sort of thing. He have a little business on the side that he does, a cleaning company, janitorial.
Yeah.
And the other one, he lives in Birmingham, but he has a house in Harlow still. But he lives in Birmingham, and he's not very, very well. He has a problem with, he has a thin nerve in his brain, and sometimes he get, it's like seizures, but not real seizures.
I'm sorry to hear
that. Yeah. So he's managing, and he does work and things like that. So those are my 3 children. Anyway, went to school, went into nursing. My first nursing was at Neasden Hospital at the Fevers. You don't know about Fevers Hospital. You know, now there's a posh name. They would call it infectious diseases.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, you had measles, you had people with mumps, you had
polio,
but not many polio at that time. But TB and all of that was rife in the 60s. So when I trained at Neasden Hospital. Then I went to train at Train Barnet, where I got a registered mental nurse. Worked there for years. Then I went down to Whittington and did general nursing. Then in central London, I went and did counseling and all of these things. And so in the end, I ended up at Anglia. university with a specialist practitioner in community mental health. So, you know, you go up through the ranks and everything. And I've been there quite happy, enjoying myself, children grown. And I came out to Jamaica on a holiday because I was a little bit, said I need a break, I need to come and relax, enjoy myself. The college there at the time, they couldn't get anybody to teach mental health and management. Mm. So when I went back to England, they called me and offered me a job. And I thought, well, oh, well. And everybody said, go for it, go for it. So that's how I came to Jamaica. And but in England, in my church, I'm a Seventh-day Adventist. And we have a strong community services department in our church, you might have heard. And strong health department and, you know, various departments. So I was a part of the community mental community services department. So they gave me 18 small groups to run as a volunteer and do my full-time job. I do some counseling part-time.
Three kids and
volunteers. They were big by then, you know, past teenage. So, and so in those 18 groups, in community services, you know, we had to go to central London to feed the homeless. And to get them into night shelters and get them into jobs and things like that. So that's when I really did a lot of work with the homeless. So
In London.
When IRA was dropping the bombs in central London, sometimes the bomb was behind us. all along East London, all along from Essex, come right down that corridor.
Did you ever have contact with for example, the Jamaican High Commission when you were in London?
Not much.
It's more through the church and church through networks the church. And volunteering.
No, at one time we had a Jamaican, England Jamaican little group like, and that was when we had the most dealings with them because they would come now and again and talk, but not much. Mainly about passport. Mainly passport and birth certificate.
So what
and
year
things
was
that?
that you had those discussions?
That was ages, but in the mid-70s.
No, so that's very interesting. So the High Commission was aware that Jamaicans needed to, that people of Jamaican descent and Jamaicans who were recognized as British needed to
have passports.
I don't really like the word regularize their status, but they had to make sure that their documents were up to date.
Because so most of us who were, some of the peer persons have died now, but to think of it, most of us who went to that, it was just a small group. Most of us who went to that group never got caught because we applied for British citizenship.
But what effort did the High Commission go to reach out to the broader Jamaican community? Was it something that was flagged basically as being...
No, it wasn't anything.
So it was seen as something that was important but was not kind of...
Not that, but I think maybe persons weren't that interested. Jamaicans weren't that
interested
because they just didn't believe. Even now, people come back and say, "I've been there so long, I never think or never thought." It might not just be lack of knowledge, because when the government, when various things change, it's well publicized and you hear it. But people just don't think it doesn't apply to them. I think so. But at that time, in the mid-70s, because I was already at. Friend Barnett, when we used to have the little meetings, no big time meetings, but you know, a few of us used to get together, and we did have links then. But I think it was because quite a few of those persons had retired and come home, and they were okay. Yeah.
So with this perspective you had this Jamaican British perspective, where you're a British citizen, you have your British passport, but you're also working now at a centre where you're receiving deported people deported from the UK, and also you've acknowledged that one person who was British. Did you have any insight into the how big this scandal was? And how big a problem it was at all?
No, I still don't know how big it is. Being here, I don't know how big it is.
Okay.
I really don't know. I don't know.
And just finally, tell us about your MBE then, please. Because
I think because we, Well, I suppose somebody must have been following me somewhere or something. Because then once I came and I taught at the school for a little while, I used to take the students out. So because I'd left Jamaica for so long, I didn't understand the community and I didn't understand what was happening. Yeah. And from day one, I saw people on the streets, homeless. Yeah. And I left the teaching full time to come and work with Ministry of Health in Community Mental Health as the specialist practitioner, which was nice and I enjoyed it. But then again, I left that because I thought the Lord had something else for me to do. And that was when I was called now. So being called to that committee, I was able to give my experiences of working both with mentally ill and working with homeless persons. So that was when everything came together. And then we co-founded this organization. I've been here ever since. I said I'd give them 2 year full-time, 1 year part-time, and it has gone. It's now 2022, and I'm still here doing more than full-time. So I think it's the impact that this place has made, because it's a model, and it's a model even for Caribbean, even for, we are a member of the Citygate Network, which is the American international organization where they do mission, mission. Even City Mission is a part of it and everything. So it's, we're part of international organizations, and many of them come and look at what we are doing here because it's kind of unique. Many persons would just take in homeless person with addiction, or mother and children with, and the mother might have an addiction problem or something like that. No, we are doing so many. We take a person with addiction and we prepare them to go for detox. We don't actually do the detox, but we do the social and psychological rehabilitation and take care of some of their health, because we have a mental health clinic here the third Thursdays of each month, and the one-to-one interactions that we have. So I think it's the impact that Open Arms is making, not just in Jamaica, but worldwide. That got me there. I'm still not so sure, but I am grateful for it, and I think it has done wonders.
Mm-hmm.
For my immediate family, I brought up my children to care, and they're all doing things that involves caring, and their children are doing that, and they say, look, my mom, my grandma, you know, has been rewarded, because my youngest son, he took a year off from everything, and he came and spent it here with us, you know.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of that, and especially your personal story with me. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure to speak to you today. Thank you so much. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I would just like to say that when the guys and everybody come here, they work, they have to have good work ethic. The business people know us, and they're known for the good work ethic, and our social enterprises are geared to help them to work and to learn, and whatever skill they want, or if they want to go to university, we will raise funds and make sure they get it, and we help them to resettle whatever they need to get settled. We will do it, whether physical, psychological, social, whatever, and live out in the communities. We don't like them living with family. We like them to be independent, have money in the bank, and be independent.
Thank you so much.
Yes.